The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to Backstory. Let's hear it on WTBR-FM Pittsville with Roberta McCulloch-Dews. Thanks for tuning in. So today we have with us Mike Fazio. He's a certified financial planner with Greylock Investment Group, and he has more than 30 years of experience in investment services. But if you ask him, he's really proud about that work, but there's something that he's deeply proud about. And there's a calling on his life that holds great importance that he's not shy to tell you about or tell others about. And we're going to get into that and some more. So, Mike, thank you for joining us today. It's good to see you.
Great to be here, Roberta. I'm excited about what we're doing.
All right. So I want to start things off with the accent. You have a very New York accent. Again, this is coming from someone who grew up in the Bronx, so I kind of know New York accents. But it's not the New York that we know, that we're thinking about.
Yeah, that's true. And you're not the first person that's commented on my accent. So I am a New Yorker, but I'm what some will call an upstater. I'm from Troy, New York. So that's just about an hour's drive from here, just the other side of the Hudson River from Albany. Born and raised in Troy. And something unique about Troy is I do believe we have a bit of a downstate accent because I'm not the only one of my cohorts that gets this.
I'm so confused. Where is that accent coming from? I need to know the influences. Where is it coming from?
I honestly don't know. You know, it's probably from the influence from our parents. But, you know, my mother was full-blooded Italian, so they spoke more Italian in the house than anything else. And I don't know. I think it's more of an attitude than it is a real accent.
Interesting. So tell me a little bit about how was it like growing up in Troy?
So Troy was a cool place. It's a unique place because there are different areas of Troy that we kind of define ourselves by. I'm from what's called South Troy, which was pretty important actually growing up. We from South Troy had a certain chip on our shoulder. There was actually a saying that we went by, which was South Troy against the world. But there are many sections of Troy. There's Albia and Sycaway and Lansingburg. And there's these different locations, but they're all Troy, but they're really just different ways we defined ourselves. The section I grew up in back in the 1970s and early 80s was very ethnic. My block was all Italian. Mm-hmm. Pretty much no one spoke English on the block except the kids.
Yeah.
Mostly all the parents spoke Italian. Most of the men worked in the factories. The women worked in the homes and did whatever needed to be done. Mm-hmm. But it was a very, very blue collar neighborhood. It was very ethnic and it was a very hardworking place.
So I got to tell you a quick story because one, the fact that it's very New York that you say the block, because that's what everyone says in New York. My grandmother's block in the 80s. So we had Italian neighbors, Joey and Lena. And I got to tell you, so the memories that I have on Joey and Lena, Joey would walk up and down the block. He would take like afternoon and morning walks. So that was, I clearly remember him walking up and down the block. I also remember Lena, and they grew things in the back. It was like, I don't know. It was like, I mean, tomatoes and different things. It was just this beautiful setting. But what I remember as a child was that Lena would beckon me over to the fence, and she would say, "I have something for your mother." And she would say, "Come with me." Now, first of all, I'm looking back now, I probably had no business going in anyone's house without my parents knowing, but I did. Mm-hmm. And I would follow her into the house, and she would give me this box of white pastries. And she was like, give this to your mother. And it was a box of cookies and things, but they were always giving like treats and different things. And just, I mean, again, they were older and they definitely spoke Italian. I don't remember them speaking English, but I just remember on the block that I grew up in, it was a very mixed block. So we had, again, that mixture and the richness of ethnicity. That's something that stays with you. So I kind of have a little entry point into kind of how the flavor of those communities.
Yeah, the food, the giving was pretty common in our place too, you know. There was always food going around. There was always somebody was making something and sharing something. One of the things, and we'll get into this later, but one of the things that really flowed pretty fluidly was wine in our neighborhood, because all the old time, quote unquote, the old timers, all the old Italian men made their own wine in their yard.
Really?
Yeah, that's a real thing. Well, they made it in their bathtubs, really, but they had grapes, and they stopped, literally stomped the grapes and made wine, and they were so proud of their wine. Each man, each family had its own wine, and I don't really remember drinking much of it as a very young man, and I never really drank much of it, even though, you know, as the story will unfold, there was more drinking later. But it was not particularly good, but these gentlemen thought that their wine was, you know, like the best of the best, and it was a big deal. One of the other interesting things about our block was we would sit on the stoop, and that was an event. Like, that was an event. Like, if it was a Friday night, you know, the guys would call, "Hey, Mike, what are you doing?" I'm like, "I think we're going to sit on the stoop tonight." And
People
they're like, "All right,
watch.
cool, we'll be over." And they'd say, "We'll be over." And it would be me and my brothers and my mother and the
Wait, the whole
guys.
family would sit on the stoop?
Everybody was on the stoop.
Okay.
And the whole block was full of people on the stoop. Like, not everybody sat on the stoop every night, but you could guess there'd be, so if there were 20 homes on the block, basically 10 on each side of the street, there'd be six or eight people on the 6 or 8 stoops occupied. And, you know, you'd be sitting on our stoop, and then I'd be like, "Hey, I'm going to run over to the Savoyas and see what they're up to. Or let's go see what the Taddeos are doing. Hey, there's activity over on the Testas. Let's go see them." And that was a real thing.
Right. Well, that's also how people interacted again without when we didn't have social media, we didn't have all these other things. There were natural ways of engagement. You actually talk to
Oh
people
my God, so true.
and went to their house. And
Yeah,
if you
all the
saw the
time.
bike outside, that means you know they
Yeah.
were outside. You know, little signals like that, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, that's the neighborhood, that's the setting. What was home like for you growing up? Your home life.
So home wasn't easy. I mean, we were poor, but we were happy. We were super happy, but it wasn't easy, and it was actually pretty hard, but it was kind of all we knew, so hard just became the way we operated. I lived in a home. We lived in a what we call the flat, right? So what we would call today an apartment, but it was a two-family home. We lived in one of the flats, one of the floors, and the landlord lived on the second floor. And it was my mother, my older brother Rocco, Rocky, who was 3 years older than me, and my mother had a son through a second marriage, my brother Jason, who was 11 years younger than me. So I was 11 years old when he was born. So growing up in that house was challenging. There was very little money. My mother had, she worked very, very hard, didn't make much money. Rock didn't work. Jason was an infant. I was young, and it was pretty rough. We were one of the few blocks on the neighborhood, and then we were one of the few families on the block that didn't have two parents. I was an outlier in that my mother was divorced. Very few people got divorced in the 70s. And on and in that section of the world where, till death do us part for our people, the Italians meant, just stay miserable and stay married your whole life. Like my mother didn't do that. She separated, she divorced my father when I was three. She divorced her second husband when I was 11. So growing up was rough. There is one other thing I should mention that we haven't even talked about in the past, which is in addition to what we've talked about that shaped me, in my mother's second marriage, which only lasted a short period of time, there was also domestic violence that I had to witness as like a 10, 9, 10, 11-year-old. And that also had a quite a profound effect on me, a profound effect. Watching someone beat my mother. That wasn't my father, obviously. That was a profound experience. So it also has an impact on the way I it does I don't know that it has any impact on the way I treat people because I just think it's obviously you're supposed to treat people right. But the way I view the world and how clearly certain things are right and certain things are wrong. I said, we qualify for this program called WIC. I mean, we qualified by a mile, right? You could make up to like 24,000. And she goes, Michael, that's welfare. I said, Ma, call it what you want, but we're starving. And this is going to provide food. And we filled out the paperwork that night. And I honestly believe that that was a turning point in our lives getting better. And we were able to qualify and receive them. I don't know if any of the listeners know it, they know it. There, you get milk and cheese and cereal and juice, and it was a lifeline. Yeah, true story.
That definitely, shapes your perspective, and it allows you to understand lack.
Oh, very
And
much.
but also have compassion for those who don't have, right? So you have this sort of hard scrabble, childhood growing up. Things are tough, but you also keep your focus somehow because you are a good student. I mean, presumably you're good enough to, again, go on to UAlbany to study economics. So tell me a little bit about how you kept your focus during this time.
I was a really good student. I was a good student. I was a good athlete. I was really a good boy, so to speak. Like I was a rule follower. And it was because something was in me that just enabled me to work hard. It wasn't because I was particularly gifted in anything. I'm not genetically good at anything. I'm just, for some reason, I have this internal drive to work really hard. And here we are today at 57 years old. My alarm goes off at 4 a.m. and I get up every single day at 4 a.m.
Has it always?
Not always that early, but that fits my life today. But like at, I'm in the gym now at 5 a.m. at 57 years old. So think about how did I get there? Well, back to my childhood, for some reason, I was a pretty good student. I worked really hard. I embraced the concept of teamwork and camaraderie, and I loved my teammates, and I played football. And we worked really hard together, so I never wanted to let them down. And I would do everything in my power to be the best athlete I could and the best student I could. And I realized I might be able to go to college with this because I knew there was no way I could go to college. I knew we couldn't afford it. And I thought that maybe if I went to school, I could break this poverty chain and, make my life easier. And my mother nourished that. She totally embraced that idea, though she never went to school. She didn't really do anything other than encourage and be a loving support system. But I was lucky. I did well enough in school and I was a decent enough athlete that I got some looks to go play college football. And I started actually at the University of Rochester, where I was recruited to play. I went away. I did pretty well, but it was the first time that I was away from my family. And it really became apparent that things were not the same when I wasn't there. My older brother now, he was 21. He wasn't picking up any of the slack. Jason was 10, right? No, he was about 15, actually. Mm-hmm. If I were, no, I was 18. He was like 9 or 10 years old. I'm sorry, I'm doing the math. And I needed to get home. So I transferred to UAlbany, and that's kind of where I started my career in academics. I went one semester to Rochester, and then I came to UAlbany. And I don't know, I just had this internal drive to work super hard because I didn't want to blow the opportunity.
And even in that, from what I'm hearing, you made the shift to go back to help your family, even while you were still managing your own education and your own professional trajectory. That was still important to you. So you knew that you didn't even want to, you know, because some would say, well, you know, I'm ready to live my life. I'm going to be on my own. But you still felt this tugging and this pull to still be with your family and support them and actually switch, right, locations at your college. That's huge. So you're at UAlbany. You are continuing to be a standout. You go on to grad school. Did you know you were going to work in investment services? Like, I'm thinking, you know, when I think investment services, obviously you think it's a career path that you can really do well. Mm-hmm. Was that your thought that if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do something that I have stability in, or are you just like numbers?
So let me go back for a minute, because I haven't mentioned anything about my dad, because even though my parents were divorced when I was three, my father was still a part of my life. Mm-hmm. So my father moved out west. And he did a number of different things, but the way his career was that of a businessman, right? Okay. So he owned businesses to some degree, and he was always a very good business. He was always good with numbers and with people, and I learned how to interact, as he would define it, as a man. It wasn't as a man, it was as a human being. But of course, the old school way, they would, you know, the way your mom or your dad would teach you something. And I knew that being someone that was kind of running a business kind of made sense to me. Yeah. So when I was in grad school, I took economics, and then I said the undergraduate was economics, and then the graduate program was the MBA. So that's a master's in business administration. My thought was, I'd like to do something where I can ultimately kind of run the business the way I'd like to. So investment services is such an open architecture. There's so many different ways that you can do it that I thought this could be a plan for me. So while I was in grad school, I interned for what was a brokerage firm back then called Payne Weber. I worked for Payne Weber. I got my feet wet in the investment business. I really felt like it made sense to me. I had the right assets. I had the right gift. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be super intellectual. You don't need to be, you know, I know some folks that are super, super smart, but they can't sell anything. Mm-hmm. I'm relatively smart. I understand the business, but I know how to connect with people.
Right.
Right. So when I got back to grad school, I focused on that. I got out of school. I went to the best brokerage firm you could find, and I went to work for Merrill Lynch, and they hired me. And once you go to Merrill Lynch and start your career, one of two things are going to happen. Either you're going to stay at Merrill Lynch forever, or you're going to leave and somebody else is going to hire you, because you're going to have as good a set of training that you could possibly get.
Wow. All right. So you mentioned your dad, and you talk about your dad and the business acumen. And so I'm sensing that you're crediting your acumen from your dad.
My dad's a complicated story, because my dad was a gambler. So the underlying issue here is that my father, though he ran businesses, his real love in life was gambling.
Okay.
At a very, very high level. So you could bring that back to the Italian neighborhood from Troy, New York, and you can think, oh, well, that makes sense, right? But that the community that it came from, it was very, very common that many of the men were in that world of gambling, bookmaking, loan sharking. So I saw money, lots of money. So what do I credit my dad with driving me to be a broker or financial services guy? I kind of credit my dad with learning the value or how important it is and how exciting it can be to try to help me make money and others make money.
Got it.
So it's a complicated answer to a simple question.
Yeah. All right. So you're down this path. You enter this really great career. You obviously work for a number of different places, Merrill Lynch, I think ACO you mentioned previously.
ACO, that's a very well-regarded consulting firm, which is now owned by Goldman Sachs.
Okay.
So it's a very reputable outfit. But then I came to the Berkshires 27 years ago, and I've been here ever since.
All right. So tell me a little bit about during your career, did you find the fulfillment that you were seeking? You obviously had this hard scrabble, gritty childhood that showed you a lot of things, made you grow up faster than maybe you would have wanted. When you got everything that you wanted, was it all that you thought it would be?
It's all that I want now, but it wasn't always that way.
Okay.
So when I was at Merrill, so I'm in my early 20s, things are going well, we're making money, a little bit of money, living a pretty good life. But I came to find out later in life that, you know, I was always seeking more, right? Which leads to this other side of my life, which is that I currently live in the world of recovery. I live in the world of recovery from addiction. Well, back in the early 20s, I didn't know about that. What I did know is that I wasn't satisfied. I wanted more, and I wanted more of everything. So like most 25-year-olds who have a master's degree and a pretty good job, it wasn't at all unusual for us to go out for a few drinks after work. So let's say I was roughly 25 years old at that time, and we would go out for a few drinks after work. Well, that led to a 15-year stretch of really running down a road of more drinks after work and more drinks and more of other substances for about a 15-year period, when my life got better and better and better and better, and I made more money and I had a bigger house. I was married to a beautiful, wonderful woman. I have two wonderful children, and it wasn't enough. None of it was enough. And it wasn't enough because for some reason, and I don't know why, and I don't care why, but I went down this road where addiction grabbed me. Drugs and alcohol, and I had about a 15-year stretch, basically from 25 to 40, when, you know, I didn't never lost a job, never really got in trouble.
Right.
Never got in trouble with the law.
So you were like a functioning addict that you were able
super
to.
Super high.
Yeah.
I was flying. I was super high. I mean, super highly functioning. I was at Merrill Lynch, then I was at ACO. And then I was at the first organization here in the Berkshires. And listen, there's a lot of folks out there that operate at a pretty high level that are highly functioning. And eventually most of us crash and burn, right? You just hope that that crash and burn doesn't kill you. In my case, fortunately, it didn't kill me. So I crashed and burned because I finally couldn't do it anymore. There's an old saying in recovery that I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. But to your point, I did live, and I was very highly functioning for that 15-year stretch.
So, Mike, with that being said, we're going to take a quick pause right now just for a quick break, and then we'll be back in about 30 seconds.
Whoa, like what exactly is happening here?
89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs. Greylock Federal, opportunity grows here. With locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org. And from Evco Hypnosis. Want to lose weight, quit smoking, sleep better, or relieve stress and anxiety? Evco Hypnosis is here to help you become happier, healthier, and stronger. Call 413-212-0283 or go to evcohypnosis.com. That's EVCOhypnosis.com.
We all know WTBR is great to listen to on 89.7 FM, but did you know that you can listen to WTBR just about anywhere? We've got a web stream, and it's easy to use. Go to WTBRFM.com on your computer and click play. You can use the TuneIn app on your smartphone and connect it to your car's sound system. Or you can use your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play WTBRFM, and there's your community radio station. WTBR, for the love of radio.
All right. So to my guests just tuning in, we have Mike Fazio. He is a certified financial planner, but he is also a recovering addict, and he is very open and transparent about his story. And prior to the break, we were just talking a little bit about how he was able to live with his addiction for the many years that he was dealing with this. And so you mentioned, Mike, that you were highly functioning. You were able to go to your job. You were able to do all the other things. If you were at that level where you were highly functioning, what was a proverbial crack in the dam? What happened?
Well, that's a good question. So back to being highly functional, I think it's part of a fun. I think part of it is my ability to, I'm a grinder, right? Like I said earlier, I've always been someone that's been fortunately, I've been fortunate in that I'm a hard worker. It's just, I'm just lucky, to be honest. Like I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to the gym because it's not that hard for me, right? I'm very fortunate that I love to grind. So and grind is a good thing, right? I can be a grinder. And I did that during the period of time, this 15-year period. So what was the crack in the dam? So I got sober in January of 2008. So January 30, 2008 is my sober date. October of the year prior, a very close friend of mine OD'd. And he didn't die, but he came pretty close. And we were like brothers, and it was pretty traumatic. It was a pretty traumatic experience for all of us. The wives got in the loop then because we were all married. The wives then became aware of what their husbands were doing because one of them had just OD'd. So it wasn't a stretch to think, oh my God, are you guys all doing this stuff?
Yeah.
And the answer was the only person that was me. So my wife came to me and said, what's going on? Like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? And after enough arguing and defending myself, my mother came over one night and said, Michael, what is going on? Like, what is going on in your life? And I said, I don't know. I think I need help. So it wasn't, Roberta, it wasn't like I didn't get a DWI. I didn't lose a job. I didn't lose anything. I just finally realized that, like, I couldn't stop. So I got sober in January of 08, but on July of 07, my son turned seven. So on 7/7/07, my son turned seven, which is kind of a cool block of numbers. And I remember getting up that morning saying, today's the day I'm going to not use. And I couldn't get to 11 o'clock in the morning. So from that point, from July of 07 to January of 08, I knew that I had a big problem.
And when you say use, Mike, are we talking like hard drugs
Yeah,
or?
we're talking alcohol and cocaine.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we're talking about. Yeah, I couldn't not use. I couldn't not use. So I knew that from July to January, like I lived in this hell where I knew I had a big problem, but I didn't know how to stop. Now, keep in mind, in 07, the kids were 7 and 10. Clearly, Michael was, my son was 7 because it was his birthday on 7/7/07. So on January 30th of 2008, I called an old buddy that I went to high school with and said, "Tommy, I think I need help, and I don't know what to do." So he said, "Why don't you come to a meeting?" I said, "Okay, like what does that mean? Like what do you mean? What's a meeting?" He's like, "It's an AA meeting." I said, "Okay." And I'm a good foot soldier. Like I said earlier, I'm a good student. I'm a good foot soldier. So I wasn't at all bothered by the thoughts of like, "Oh my God, I can't go to AA." Like that's beneath me. Yeah, there was nothing beneath me. I grew up back, we talked about where I grew up. We didn't have any money. So I didn't, there was no beneath me. So I went to this meeting with my, with this old buddy of mine who has been now sober. He just celebrated 33 years. We've been in each other's lives ever since. And I went to a meeting, and then I went to another meeting, and I would go to a meeting, and I would feel like, you know, I would be in dire straits, and I would go to a meeting, and I would feel better. So I figured maybe I'll go to a meeting again tomorrow. And it, that's really how it started.
For someone who has not gone through addiction and maybe attended these meetings, when you talk, when you think about your transformation and your change, was it something that it came through either the conversations, the actions that they asked you to take? What how, what did that look like for you? Because obviously you're not the person that you were then,
Right.
but so something had to happen in between. What was that level of discipline and action on your part to get you to this place?
So here's, this could go, this could take a very long time. And of course, I won't do that. And so for the listener who has been through recovery, they get it. And for those who haven't, they don't. But here's what it kind of boils down to. If you really want to embrace the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, meetings are mandatory because what happens in meetings is A, you start to learn about the program. B, you make connections with like-minded people that are struggling with the same thing. And it could be, you know, when I say like-minded people, we are people from all different walks of life, right? Like really, really different walks of life. Investment guys, lawyers, doctors. And then homeless folks. Like we are all different walks of life, but everybody has a desire to stop drinking. That's kind of the premise. And when I talk about AA and NA, I use interchangeably because NA is Narcotics Anonymous, AA is Alcoholics Anonymous, very similar programs. I utilize both fellowships. My focus has been primarily in AA just because it's a lot easier to attend. There's AA meetings everywhere, all day, every day. It's a little less frequent with NA meetings. But anyway, so you go to meetings, you learn a little bit about the program, you start to make connections. But where you really transform, Roberta, where the real magic happens, is when you embrace the concept of the book, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called, we call it the big book. And in the big book, there's a series of steps. Hence, it's a 12-step program. These steps were written out many years ago, and they are in order for a reason. And they are to be done with another or others. So we don't do the program alone. We do it together. Now, when I went through the steps, I reached out to a gentleman who is a dear friend of mine now. He wasn't then. He was a gentleman that I knew. I knew he was a hardcore guy. I knew he was somebody that was going to hold me to account. And I went to him and said, I need your help. Will you take me through the steps? And he said to me, if you're willing to put in the work, I'm willing to put in the time. I committed, he committed, and 9 months later, I had completed this 12-step program. Now, of course, we can't get into what that entails today. We could do it at another time.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're through the steps, you've cleaned the wreckage of your past. You've cleaned out why you weren't satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
You dig deep as to why you weren't fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, you identify your part in all these resentments that you have. You identify your part, mm-hmm. not anybody else's part.
Yeah.
And you then live in the steps. Now, I am consumed by this work now, because mm-hmm. I could go on and on about what I do now in the program. But that was the transformation for me.
And after those steps, did you feel strong enough to, like, I'm good, I'm fine? Did the light bulb go off and you felt like, okay, I've crossed the threshold and I'm going to be okay now? Or was there still a little bit of trepidation even after you completed it that you could go back anytime?
Yes to all of that.
Mm.
Oh, I'm good. I'm solid. I'm strong, but I'm not invincible. And the only way to keep my sobriety is twofold. Show up every day and keep giving it away. So how do I give it away? I now take people through the steps. I lead a step workshop that meets every Saturday morning at 7 a.m.
Where do you do that?
So one of my core meetings, so I go to meetings 4 times a week,
okay.
Right? One of my core, matter of fact, tonight is one of my core meetings. But one of my, or my kind of my home group, mm-hmm. is Saturday morning at the McCowanville Church, which is in Albany on Western Avenue. And we meet at 8 a.m., but at 7 a.m., we have a step workshop that's run by a couple of the senior guys, like guys like myself who've been around a bit. And we take young people. Well, they don't have to be young, but they usually tend to be younger. We take people through the steps. So I live in the steps.
Hmm.
Like literally daily. And it's just it's such a fabulous thing to own your own stuff,
mm-hmm.
and be aware of what your part is in mm-hmm. something and fix that part. I can't fix what you do,
right?
But I can fix what I do.
So it makes me think about, Mike, as you're talking about sort of this cleansing and self-ownership and things of that nature. When you think about what led you into your addiction, it wasn't the substance itself, but underlying factors. I'm hearing that, I guess, you used it as a mask, to cover up other feelings.
I believe so. I think if I could go back to when it all started, what kind of drove me, and I think it's just as simple as I wanted to drink like a man.
Oh.
I think I wanted to drink like a man. Like I mm-hmm. remember thinking when my brother turned 16 years old and we were out west. When I say out west, I mean Colorado. That's where my dad moved to. Mm-hmm. We took Rock out to dinner and one of my dad's friends bought him a shot of Jack Daniels for his 16th birthday. And when we went back to my father's house, my attitude was, if Rocky can do it, I can do it. And I snuck into the liquor cabinet and I took a pull off a bottle of Jack Daniels. I was 13. That was the first time I'd ever drank, I believe. That's what I remember. And I remember it burning, which is pretty common for everybody who recalls their first drink, and thinking, I want to drink like a man. Like, I want to be able to drink like, and I define that as being important.
Yeah.
Right. So as when I started drinking, like a lot of people start drinking, they drink, you know, like out of a red Solo cup at a, what we would call a bush party. We call them bush parties in New York. I don't know what they, 'cause they'd be in the woods, right? So they were bushes.
Yes.
But for some reason, it quickly escalated for me to be in bars. And when I was in a bar, drinking like a man meant you ordered a drink. And I remember I was probably like 16 years old, and I was in a bar in Albany, and my father found out about it, and he called me, and he said, I heard you were at such and such a bar last night. And now he's in Colorado, I'm in New York, and I'm like, I literally just got home like 4 hours ago. How do you know this? He goes, Michael, I have eyes everywhere, and I know what's going on. And the only thing he asked me was, what did you drink? And I said, I think I drank, and I know what I drank, actually. I drank vodka and grapefruit juice. And he said, yeah, men drink with water. And I'm like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And he said, they drink scotch and water or rye and water. I didn't even know what that meant.
Yeah.
But I, next time I went to a bar, I ordered rye and water. And rye, you know, then it turned into scotch, and then I was off to the races. But
yeah.
But it was important to drink like a man.
Well, it's interesting that you mention your dad not being in your life at that time, and this is something that he co-signed, and then you did something that was pleasing to him, and, you know, almost that approval, and in a way you kind of, you know, went down a path of doing things, it would seem, to that would make him happy.
Yeah.
But at your detriment, you know. You know, what about your kids? Did your kids ever see you in a state, or they never saw that side of you? Because I know you
hard to know. Hard to know. Yeah. Hard to know. You know, so Michael was 8 and Alex was 11 when I got sober. My children are Michael and Alex. Alex is a girl, Alexandra. What the kids saw more was 5 years of me in early sobriety, mm-hmm. and their mother, my wife at the time, in chaos, because her world was unraveling. She couldn't believe what was happening under her nose, right? So think about it. I was married in 92. I don't get sober till 08, right? So we're together a long time, right? And that wasn't always bad, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't always bad, but
yeah.
We were married, you know, and I was never really bad. I was a bad alcoholic, but I was never a bad guy.
But like, let's talk about that. Like, you, the fact that you were able to compartmentalize your life in that way, that's a huge feat in and of itself, because a lot of times you don't see that neatness. It normally spills over,
yeah.
where there's an episode, an incident that shows it on full display. But it seems like you're able to have things so neatly packaged until you got to that point where enough was enough.
Yeah. I decided that it was over. And that's a great point, Roberta. I was able to keep it compartmentalized. And again, not to sound chauvinistic, but again, it was my father in my head saying, act like a man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you want to go do what you want to go do? That's fine. But make sure you take care of your family, which means go to work, earn your money, bring the kids to soccer and football and dance and horseback riding, take your wife on vacation, right? Do all that stuff. And then if you want to do your own thing on the side, which for me was alcohol and drugs,
yeah.
that's what it was. That's all it was. That's all it ever was. But for some reason, I was able to do it. I was.
And how then, do you, yeah.
No, go ahead, please.
No, go ahead.
So what did the kids experience? So
yeah.
The first 5 years of my recovery, we were battling through my addiction or my recovery, but my wife's insecurity about what else was going on that I didn't know about. And she was pretty spun up about that, when in fact, there was nothing else that was going on. Literally nothing. See, what real hardcore drug addict alcoholics care about is drugs and alcohol. Nothing else. They don't care about anything else. It's not like what you see in the movies.
Yeah.
Okay. So we worked hard at keeping our stuff together, but it was pretty volatile. So the kids saw that. And our marriage didn't survive. Our marriage didn't survive. We separated in 13. We divorced in 14. We hated each other's guts for 15, 16, 17-ish. I went through the steps, made my amends, which was step 9. I know that I'm bouncing around, but I went through the steps in 17, 2017, made my amends to Mary, and everything changed. Mary and I, my first wife, we hated each other. She hated me. I hated her. I went through the steps in 2017.
Yeah.
I made my amends. I'm remarried. She's remarried. We're all spending Saturday at her lake house in Lake George.
So you have, wow, there's a lot there. There's so much there that goes way beyond this time for this conversation, but there seems to have been a lot of work that you put in, for one, forgiveness on both ends to set in, and for you to be at a place now where you're not just pleasantries because you share children, but you actually like each other enough to hang out and have your spouses hang out. That's huge.
The work that we do, which is a love, it's a passion, it's a labor of love, is everything.
Wow.
It's all about the work. Like, I've become known in the program, I've sponsored a number of young people, and they'll all say, well, you all know who my sponsor is. And the only thing he says is, do the work. Don't talk to me. Just do the work. Now, I'll do it with you.
Yeah.
But we're going to do the work.
Well, go ahead.
If you do the work, you can come and you can have a life that you never even dreamt of.
That work, when I think about everything that it entails, you know, and I think, you know, Mike, I think I've told you this before. Like, a lot of times when people see you, they see the you today, right? Mm-hmm. And so they can't even imagine all of the work because they see you put together and they think, well, what does he know?
Mm-hmm.
How can he tell me about this work? What does he know? And so how do you soften up people to help them to understand that, listen, what you see is not the full story. I put in the work. I can help you put in the work, but you got to trust me. How do you build those relationships?
That's a great question. You're really good at this. That was a phenomenal question. And I'll tell you exactly how I do it. So I live in two spaces if I'm not at work. I live in the rooms of recovery, or I live in the rooms of the gyms. And I treat both of those places the same way, because I'm good at recovery because I work really hard at it. And I'm good in the gym because I work really hard at it. And because I'm older now and I've got gray hair and I'm not 25 anymore, I'm a little bit of an outlier in, not so much in the rooms of AA, but in the rooms of the weightlifting gyms I go to. I just literally will just, when the time is right, I will go over to somebody and say, like, for instance, this happened today. There's a young kid in the gym. I love him. We call him P. And I'm like, P, I haven't seen you. Where have you been? What are you doing? You look great. You know, like, and we'll spark a conversation. Now, this young man wants to work in the investment business. And we started talking about that. I got his phone number. I'm going to help him. So how do I address it? How do I address it in the gyms as I go up and I just start chatting with somebody? And I got enough street cred to be able to do that. In the rooms of AA, it's a softer approach. Because sometimes somebody comes in and they're wide-eyed. They don't know what to do. I'm meeting with a new guy tonight at 7 o'clock over at St. Pius, which is one of the meetings we go to. But what I'll tell him is, let's start out slow. We can help you. There's somebody in here that's been through what you have. I'm not going to say it's me. It probably was. But I can help you. I'm not going to be overbearing. I can be a resource to you. And let's start out by just saying, what's your first name? And like, how do you do it, Roberta? You do it with love and kindness and genuine regard for another person. And because I look the way I do, right, 6 foot tall, bald head, 225 pounds, I'm wearing a suit, I'm in reasonable shape, it looks like this guy's got it all going on. His life has been easy. Yeah, it's been nothing, buddy, nothing like that. Mm. But because I come to them, I go in and embrace them.
Yeah.
I either rub them wrong right off the bat, or they, right, or they're like, I don't know, this guy seems pretty genuine.
Yeah.
So I've had a lot of success with it. Like, I can't tell you how many, I don't know how many people I've turned off, because if, I guess if I turn them off, they never come back.
Well, but that's true.
It seems like they keep growing. Like, it seems like I have more people on my phone list now than I've ever had.
You do you like have a text, like a chat where you just text folks and just say, how you doing? How's it going?
All the time.
All the time.
Are you kidding? All day, mm-hmm. every day.
Okay.
My phone is dinging all day. And more often than not, it's just either somebody's got a problem or it's just like, hey, man, what's up? How are we doing today? And a lot of times the response is, I'm not doing too good. Like, life is kicking my butt today. And it isn't, I'm going to go drink, I'm going to go use. It's just, I kind of feel antsy.
Yeah.
I kind of feel antsy. So my wife, Corey, who's learning about recovery with me because she lives with it, says that she's never met anybody in her life who is so connected to so many people in from so many different walks of life. And it's all recovery or fitness. And I think the two of those things go together. I think that in recovery, if you start to work and you try to train your mind, body, and spirit, it'll all come together. It all comes together. And I think taking care of your body is really important, because we only got one shot at this.
That's true.
And we need to take care of ourselves.
That's true. Wow. Another question that I have for you, Mike, when I think about the path that you're on and how you stay on that, you know, the exposure to the different distractions and things, especially in your line of work, how do you stay on that straight and narrow? Because there are so many events and so many different things, and it's all around. And how do you keep that focus? Like, what are some practical things that, like, you would tell someone else?
So early on in my recovery, so you're talking about being surrounded by alcohol.
Yeah.
Like being at a gala I mean, so early on in my recovery, you know, we had a lot of like sayings and slangs, and like one of the things that you would say is, you know, think the drink through. So think the drink through, because if you think it's hard to stay away from the first drink, try staying away from the second, because you're dead. You got no shot. So really think about having that first drink. And and if you think you're going to, right, think about the consequence that might follow. And if that's not enough, then by all means, just pick up the phone and shoot somebody a text and say, I'm not doing too well. And we get a lot of that. Like the old guys like myself, we get a lot of that where, you know, one of the younger folks is like, I'm not doing too well. Like, I'm at this wedding, and then we can help either walk them through it, go get them. So that was what it was like originally. Now, it means nothing to me.
Yeah.
It means nothing.
It's so interesting, because for people who, not necessarily who have gone through addiction, but even just people who say, I'm not going to drink or something, the minute you say, sometimes people say, why? Or they say, what happened? It's so ingrained in the way that in our culture, in how we celebrate, that those who don't, oftentimes questions start to arise. So I think for people who are even on that path too, you're bucking the system. You're going against sort of the normal tide, because it's different. And so it's finding those alternatives. And I think today there are so many different alternatives that people can opt for, so they don't have to feel they're isolated and have to make these decisions where they're the only ones. But you know, Mike, I just want to ask you this. I know our time is it's coming close, but you know, as you think about you know, we talked about some of the lessons you give others, but I want to ask you, who or what motivates you to keep going down this path? You're sort of like an OG, you're a veteran in this, but everyone needs a little bit of inspiration and motivation. So where do you get that from?
Two places, really. So I think if you're open to learning, lessons can come from everywhere. So where I really learn, believe it or not, my children are an enormous sense of drive and an opportunity for me to learn. My kids are really smart. They know everything there is to know about my recovery. They've lived in it. They're aware of it. They're aware of all of it. And I want to continue to be a role model for them. Like when your kids call and say, "Hey, Dad, can you talk to so and so? Because they're not doing too well." And like, you know what to do. Like, you know what to do. So that's one of the driving forces. The other is the people in the program that came before me that embraced me. Like, my network of people is like age and race and gender, none of that. We don't care about any of that. Like, it means nothing. But like, there's some older men, there's some younger women, there's people from all walks of life. But like, my core group, some of the older folks that came before me that guided me really give me inspiration, because they'll come back to me and say, "Geez, you're working with so and so, and you know, he looks a lot like you did 15 years ago." And I'm like, "How so?" And they're like, "Well, you were an angry lunatic who didn't know what to do. And we guided you. And you did it, and now you're guiding him." So I look to the old timers and I look to my kids. And quite frankly, my wife is an enormous part of this too, because she's so normal and she's so even. And I strive to be normal and even. And it's, I'm pretty normal, but I'm not very even. I
What do
kind of,
you mean by that?
well, I'm emotional. I'm
Okay.
emotional. So I have to reel that in. Like, I have
Okay.
to reel that. And I haven't done a great job of reeling it in today, because I think it's okay.
Yeah.
But sometimes you have to reel it in, because it can come across as being abrasive, you know,
Right.
aggressive,
Yeah,
you know,
understood.
arrogant. Like,
Yeah.
there's one thing I get a lot of is, you know, "You're not as arrogant as I thought you were when I first met you." And I'm
Well,
like,
are they the but they're making that assumption just based on not even talking with you. They're just it's yeah, I could see that, Mike. I mean,
right.
you know, we've talked about this, you know. It's like if just look, you think, okay, what does he know?
Right.
Not, you know what I mean? Like what do you know about some of those struggles? And you've gone through a lot. And I think what people do is that's a bad thing, right? They judge you.
Yeah.
You're
Well,
judged.
it's okay. I get it. I get it, because I judge people, right? I judge them, but I have a skill set now where like, I only judge them for a minute. And then I'm like, "Well, what are you doing? Stop judging this guy. You don't even know him." Right. And then, you know what I normally do? I go over and introduce myself to him. That's actually what I do. Like, especially if I don't like him. If I made the decision for some reason that I don't like that guy,
Yeah.
I go over and say, "Hey, I'm Mike. What's your name?"
That makes sense.
It's cool. It's not easy.
It's not. You have to have a level of openness there. Well, you know, Mike, yours is a story that I think a lot of people can relate to. You know, it's one that you are obviously very open and transparent about. A lot of lessons there. I think, you know, the fact that you can be down and out, you can rise up again, and that you don't also have to live in the shadows, right? And that, you know, what I got from our conversation too is that when you go through something like this, being able to help others and help them get to the other side, just like you got to the other side. And so, you know, I just want to thank you for this conversation. Thank you for all of it, being open, transparent, sharing. You know, hopefully maybe we can have a part two at one point, because I feel like there's just so much with your story that I wasn't able to ask because we just have an hour. But it's definitely been a real pleasure. Someone, thank you. To my listeners, you've been listening to Backstory Let's Hear It on WTBR-FM Pittsfield with Roberta McCulloch-Dews. Thanks for listening and have a great day.